So I know many of you in the room, and I'll just introduce myself to those I don't yet know. My name is Devin Haza, and I use she, they pronouns. I come from Southern Oregon, which is the land of the Latgawa people, a small town called Ashland. And currently I live nomadically, and so my partner Nico and I, we travel in a van, and we live most of the time in our camper van, although we have a lot of good friends who host us around all over the place. And we're here for an extended stay at IMS, really lucky. I've been here already for a month, teaching some of the RC and doing my own practice. And so just really a great, great honor to get to be here with you in March. My most favorite long retreats have been spent here. And in fact, I was just realizing it's almost exactly the 10-year mark, pretty much almost exactly a 10-year mark, where I sat my first 5-month retreat here. And just feeling this sense of, since then, it's been a lot of sitting and visiting here and just feeling all the blessings of this place. So my dear friend and colleague, Rebecca Bradshaw, will be joining us as well for the month, and she'll be here on Monday with you. So for those of you who are new to the refuge, we often just kind of talk about whatever we want to. Sometimes there's themes for the month, and I know many here in the room will be practicing some form of metta. And so Rebecca and I both really love the practice of metta, and we'll each be offering some reflections around the heart qualities, in addition to other things, other dhammas. But in particular, tonight I want to offer reflections, commentary, stories related to this Karaniya Metta Sutta. This sutta, I think everyone got a copy of this, and some might know it very well, might be familiar to you. My very first experience with this Metta chant, Buddha's words on Metta, was during a solitary retreat in the mountains of Colorado. I was sitting my first month long alone, very, very solitude. I wasn't seeing anyone. I wasn't talking to anyone. People would like drop off groceries for me. It's very solitary. And I had this sutta. I had just sort of happened upon it. I think actually a friend had given me a copy of the sutta. I'd never heard of it before. And I taped it to my door, the inside of the door, this tiny little cabin I was in. And I would read it while I was brushing my teeth every day, just read this Metta Sutta. And because I was very lonely in my solitude, something about reading this particular teaching and reflection really touched me. There was a kind of accompaniment and solace that I found in these words. So I'm going to read it, and you're welcome to follow along. We'll be chanting this later on in the month. We'll let you know when we start the practice of evening chanting. We won't start for the first week or so, but we will be chanting this together. So we'll chant both in Pali and English, but tonight I'll read the English, and you're welcome to follow along, or just in your mind if you know it. The Buddha's Discourse on Loving Kindness. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, freed from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision and being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. And those who have been here, I know you heard this. I know you heard the sutta from Jeannie. So I wanted to expand on what Jeannie offered earlier this week. And for those, you might really be familiar with this sutta. You might know it really well. But I want to spend a little bit of time really looking at this. What is this teaching saying? The first few stanzas are really about what are the conditions in place for this friendliness, this goodwill to arise in us. What are these conditions? This is the path of peace. For one who is skilled in goodness. So skilled in goodness, really it's the precepts that we already chanted. This sense of sila. Living a life that is aligned with our values, with what matters to us. And the Buddha is recommending we be straightforward and gentle in speech. This one, I think, is a really important practice when we're out in the world talking. Straightforward and gentle, such a deep practice, actually. Can we really be direct and gentle at the same time? Metta isn't always nice. But can we be straightforward and gentle? And I think these are also really good practice instructions for how we're talking to ourselves when we're here in retreat. How is it to be really honest, upright, straightforward, and also so gentle, exceedingly gentle with ourselves? Yep, we're meeting each moment with truth and honesty and soft. Gentle. It's like this. And then right away, it's pretty important to be contented and easily satisfied. This is a big one, and I actually think there's something about the conditions at the refuge here where we already are simple. And there is a kind of contentment that arises. We're easy to support. There's a kind of frugality just built into our way of life here. And so in some ways you can relax. You just have your suitcase full of things. That's it. So you have the conditions here already. Contented and easily satisfied. I think this also means gratitude. Just thinking about all of the conditions that brought you here, the people who are supporting your life at home, your pets, your family, all the people here that have offered to support this place, the staff, the other yogis, all of us here, the supportive conditions. So just reflecting on this. These are all lines, these are reflections you can have as you move through the days. All these conditions that are supporting your goodwill, your kindness to arise. And then this line in particular, this one feels like a pretty serious reckoning. We should be unburdened with duties. And how many of us get really busy? You know, I find this very humbling that even living a Dharma life, we can feel very busy. There's all these things to do, and I kind of rush around doing errands. And it's really interesting to watch my mindset. If I'm in a rush, if I'm putting things in the grocery cart, checking out, there's a kind of burdened sense. It's much harder to just see the person in front of me. The sense, okay, this is a person. I have goodwill for them. Just rushing through. And so here in the space, hopefully you can feel unburdened with duties and just sense into, oh, how is it to be sharing space together? We care about other beings. And then this line, let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. So this line is pointing to a particular teaching. I want to spend some time unpacking this teaching. This is talking about hiri and otapa. So maybe you've heard these Pali words. Hiri is a kind of healthy conscience, and otapa is concern. Healthy concern. So conscience internal and concern for what others, what wise ones, would think of our actions. So sometimes we can feel a lot of guilt and shame. But hiri and otapa are like the healthy versions of our guilt and shame. They're guardians. And they're powerful, but they feel good. Not a sense of sinking kind of shame. They actually help us sit up a little straighter. And there's a sense of, oh, I can do it. I can do better. These healthy guardians that keep us happy inside and also keep a happy community. Hiri and otapa. So many of you know that I've spent the last few years through the COVID pandemic in a lot of cabin retreat. And I want to share tonight in particular, I have a lot of stories from these retreats. We're in Southern Oregon in the mountains and very lucky, you know, rustic cabin, but a really sweet support team, a really good caretaker, and in particular, a wonderful grocery shopper who I've actually known this person my whole life, Isabella. She's about 10 years younger than me, and so I was here at her babysitter growing up. And we're still very close, and she is she's a burly farmer, salt of the earth kind of person, very different from me. She has no interest in meditation or spirituality at all. But she's like a builder and an artist, and she grows flowers. She's a farmer. She's salt of the earth. She's very practical. And so grocery shopping was a great job. She loves it. And every week, the groceries would arrive so beautifully packed, like perfectly proportioned. She's just very good, earthy. And so I would send her a list every week. And what I started to notice is as the deliveries came on Tuesdays, it's like she would choose the less plastic option. You know, and she would reuse the olive oil jar. And just noticing the care with which she took, you know, she wasn't using plastic bags for bulk rice. She had her own kind of canvas bags that she would deliver in. And one time I ordered berries, and instead of getting the berries in the plastic containers, she chose like the frozen ones that weren't the non-recyclable plastic. It's like she would take the care. And without telling me, she was teaching me about my grocery list. And now I'm doing all my own shopping, but I think about Isabella, and when I have this option, it's like, do I buy the orange juice in the really big plastic or in a carton? It's like, well, what would Isabella do? And there's a sense of uprightness, like I can do better. I can feel good about where I'm putting my money and how I'm using groceries, maybe less waste, less plastic. So it's not out of guilt or shame, but there's a kind of inspiration. And this is Hiri-Anotapa. This is really holding this sense of guardians, not doing the slightest thing that the wise would lead or reprove. And then we come to my favorite part of this sutta. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever livings there may be, whether they're weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small. So to me, just this languaging in itself feels like there's metta there. Recognizing, oh, there's beings that have really big bodies. And there's beings that have tiny little bodies. And then there's us. We're actually called medium-sized beings. We're majjhima. We're in the middle. Our bodies are medium-sized. But there's something about that that just immediately brings metta. Like, oh yeah, we all have these different bodies. Right? Animal realm, maybe even unseen beings, near, far. Babies that are just born or to be born. It's so inclusive and so much kindness there. And maybe one reason why I like this phrase around medium, short, or small, yeah, weak or strong. My very first experience meditating was as a freshman in college. It was a very difficult year. I came in with a lot of anxiety. I didn't really want to leave home. And of course, it's a lot of the typical stuff that you feel, but for me, I've especially driven straight-A student, felt a lot of pressure to perform, a lot of insecurity that year. And I remember also wanting to ask these big questions. Like, it just really felt like there must be more to this kind of prescriptive, like, you just follow the rules and get good grades and should be happy. I was really a seeker. I was looking for, this felt since there's something underneath here, but I can't quite find it. So I was taking classes in philosophy. My philosophy professor, Randall Havis, I really loved him. He was eccentric in all the right ways. And he was a philosopher, so he, you know, he was kind of conceptual and sort of complex and difficult to understand, but he always brought his really beautiful dog to class. Every day he'd bring his dog. And he was heartfelt. He was really passionate about philosophy, and he meditated. So I remember him saying to our class, kind of offhandedly, that he was starting a meditation group on Mondays at lunch in the same philosophy classroom. So I went. This is early on in the freshman year, and there's only one other kind of dorky student there. And then Randall and his dog. And he would practice at Spirit Rock, so he's in this lineage. And we did a kind of sit, walk, sit. I think we probably sat for 20 minutes, walked for 10, sat for another 20 minutes, just in this classroom. And he gave us kind of basic instructions, I think, breathing and, you know, pay attention to your body. I didn't really know what I was doing. So we sat, and then I remember we were doing walking just back and forth between the rows of desks. Just the three of us. I was trying to feel my feet and trying to feel my legs, and something happened. I don't remember exactly how it happened, but I remember feeling a kind of goodness, just like it felt good to walk. And it felt good to be with these other two people in the classroom. And then I was near a window and I could look out, and there's a rose garden on campus, and I could see people down in the rose garden, and I felt some kind of goodness there. Like some well-wishing for those people in the roses. And then my mind went big. And I remember really thinking about whales. It was all about whales and dolphins, and I love whales and dolphins. And there's all this sense of goodness and goodwill. Like, oh, I care about them. And all these images of like the fish and other beings that live in the ocean, the turtles and octopus. And it was so joyful. And it was my first experience of metta. I didn't even know what I was doing. But it was so palpable, I still remember it. It's a touchstone for me. And often, whales are my metta object. Still, my mind just loves them. And I kept going back on Mondays because of that first experience walking and this sense of, oh wow, meditation is fun. Right? I can wish all of this goodness to these beings. And I think because that year was so difficult for me, and it really was the year that I kind of went deep, I did my first retreat that year at Spirit Rock, it was because that sense of metta and goodwill brought a little bit of ease to my heart that was so tight and aching and anxious. So metta as a doorway to peace. And then there's this line, even as a mother protects with her life, her child, her only child. And this is the image that we're given for metta. I think it's a beautiful image. It's not always fuzzy and nice and warm. If you think about a mother protecting her child, there's some fierceness there. It can be messy. Metta is very natural. Right? It's this sort of uncontrived, this sense of leaping up, right? At the sense of danger. A very fierce kindness. So it's direct, immediate, clear. Sometimes I think when we're cultivating metta, we have this sense that it has to be a certain kind of feeling, or really big, you know, we hear this unbounded sense. But what if it's just very direct? The wisdom of no kind of protection. So I'll read you this poem. I'm sure you know part of it, this famous, beautiful poem, I think, about metta. But we don't always hear all of it, so I'm going to read you the whole thing. This is St. Francis and the Sow by Galway Kinnell. The bud stands for all things, even for those things that don't flower. For everything flowers from within of self-blessing. Though sometimes it's necessary to reteach a thing its loveliness. To put a hand on its brow of the flower and retell it in words and in touch, it is lovely. Until it flowers again, from within, of self-blessing. As St. Francis put his hand on the creased forehead of the sow and told her in words and in touch, blessings of earth on the sow. And the sow began remembering all down her thick length from the earthen snout all the way through the fodder and slops to the spiritual curl of the tail, from the hard spininess spiked out from the spine, down through the great broken heart, to the sheer blue milken dreaminess spurting and shuddering from the 14 teats into the 14 mouths, sucking and blowing beneath them. The long, perfect loveliness of sow. So we often hear about reteaching a thing its loveliness and flowering from within of self-blessing, but isn't it great? St. Francis is loving the sow down her thick length, through the fodder and slops, the spiritual curl of the tail. And we see this, the spininess spiked out from the spine in her great broken heart, and then the blue milken dreaminess spurting and shuddering. She's feeding her children. This is metta. It's messy. Often we feel all covered in mud. It brings out all that difficulty. And yet this is the most direct, most basic, most natural thing. So ordinary. And I think one of the reasons why Sharon Salzberg is kind of our grandmother of metta is because the way she offers this is very ordinary. It's very direct. She's no nonsense. I love Sharon, but I always am a little scared of her too. Maybe it's because she's a New Yorker, but she's just so, like, she's not fuzzy sometimes, right? She's not so nice. She's just direct. She's done so much metta. That's the result of this, all this metta. So Sharon's story for you. She was having a bad day. And this was a few years back when she was still living in New York City before COVID. And I think it was Real Life maybe was coming out, one of her more recent books. And she got bad news from the publisher. So she was just a grump. She was grumping about bad day, bad mood. And she got into the elevator of her building. And another person joined her in the elevator. And this other person gives her a big grin and says, "It's my birthday today." And Sharon looks over. And she says, "I hope you have a happy birthday." And that's the practice of metta. Very quiet, very simple. She probably was still in a bad mood. But there is this spaciousness and enough of directness, enough of that connection of like, "Yeah, I hope it's a good day for you on your birthday." So we don't have to embellish. We don't have to push. But in some ways, I know many of you will be cultivating metta. Can we feel this sense of it's already our birthright? It's in us. And we're just laying the conditions for this very basic ordinariness, this deep sense of connection, this goodwill that's already here. Just letting it come. Also knowing it'll come with all of the mess too. And that's also a part of metta. So one way I find to just touch into this very basic, very simple way is nature. I mean, we're here at the forest refuge. There's so much nature around us. Have you noticed the trees? Trees are metta. They're constantly sending us metta. The Buddha sat under a tree for shade. You know, early in his life, he sat under a rose apple tree. That was one of his most beautiful memories. And then again, he sat under this Bodhi tree to awaken. Have y'all noticed the tree in the courtyard? That tree is famous because devas live in that tree. You don't necessarily have to believe me, but I think it's true. So many beautiful trees here. Can we feel that sense that they're sending us metta? We offer them metta. I think they like that. But they also, there's a sense of offering and receiving at the same time. Very basic metta. Metta for the rocks. Metta for the stars. We've had some really beautiful stars. This waning moon we have hanging in the sky in the morning. So those who aren't necessarily doing explicit practices of metta, you also are doing metta. Basic mindfulness is metta. Just this awareness, this willingness to connect with each moment. It's just a metta mind. And as we live in that deep sense of radical presence, we see that actually we are metta. There's no difference. It's all just connection. And that's the teaching of interdependence, of interbeing, that we start to see we're actually not separate. The metta mind, this being metta, is already just true. It's who we are. And one of our wise ancestors, the author, feminist theorist, cultural critic, bell hooks. Bell hooks, they say, when we love the earth, we're able to love ourselves more fully. I believe this. the ancestors taught me it was so. And I think it's because we see ourselves in the earth. We're not different. We're not different. So being skilled in goodness knows this, right? We know this when we're really tapped into goodness. One of my favorite stories from the suttas, many of you have heard this, I'm sure. Ananda has an insight, and he, you know, is close with the Buddha, very close. Buddha's attendant, Buddha's cousin. And so I imagine them kind of sitting together and talking, and Ananda says, "Hey, I had an insight." And the Buddha's like, "Okay, let's hear it." Ananda says, "I saw that spiritual friendship is half of the holy life." And I think Buddha, with a lot of affection, probably says, "Hey, no, actually no, Ananda. Spiritual friendship is the whole of the holy life." The whole of the holy life. I mean, the Buddha taught a lot of other things. He taught all these practices and he taught the lists. So what did he mean? What did he mean? We can often say, oh, I mean, it's about Sangha. The community is important, right? It's part of our practice, the whole of our practice. But I've been more and more interpreting this sutta on a more radical level. Like, if we look at each moment of experience, there's sensory experience, there's mental and heartfelt experience, and it's always connecting with something. And if that's the case, everything's in relationship all the time, and the whole practice is simply showing up for those relationships with ourselves, with the world, with other beings, then the whole of the holy life is simply befriending everything. This breath, this step, the wind, this other person who's breathing really loud. It's all relationship. It's all the holy life. Ajahn Sutito says this really well. So I'm going to read you, it's a little bit of a longer quote from him, but this is what he's teaching. He's saying, the main issue for the mind is how it relates to what happens. Relationship is fundamental because we're actually never a standalone being, but always a being with or a being in. Consciousness is just this awareness of being with in the various fields of seeing, hearing, tasting, smelling, touching, and thinking. And in that process of being with, consciousness automatically establishes the sense of a subject and an object. A seer who sees, a hearer who hears. And then out of that duality, the sense of self and other arises. Notice that self and other are relative positions that depend on each other. You can't have an experience of the self without an other that is in contrast to it. Even in your own mind, there appears the self as a watcher and the other as thoughts and emotions. Or the self is how you conceive yourself as being, and other is what you should be. And you can feel even in that kind of belief, there's a kind of separation. We so easily bring in fear and judgment. The separation between how things are and how I want them to be, or I should be a better yogi, should be moving differently, or practicing differently. That separation is like an original split. And it's okay as long as we're very gentle. As we're walking this path of peace, this sense of loving ourselves back into wholeness, healing that separation and fear. And so again, bell hooks, who says that when we drop fear, we can draw nearer to people. We can draw nearer to the earth. And we can draw nearer to all the heavenly creatures that surround us. So my favorite story from cabin retreat, this is again when we were in Oregon in the mountains. And I was living inside in a warm, cozy cabin, and Nico was in a tent nearby. And at one point in the retreat, it was winter time. He was living in this kind of snowsuit to stay warm, and he came and said, "I think I want some time in the cabin." And so we made this deal that for a few hours in the afternoon, I would go out and practice, and so he could have his time in the warmth. And I wanted to support him, so I agreed to it, but I was actually really reluctant. It was cold, and it was winter and snowy, and every day I had this resistance to go out. I was sort of, you know, self-pityingly putting on all my layers. And so this one day, especially, was snowing very, very hard, windy, cold, snow, fat flakes. I was like, oh, okay, kind of complaining to myself, putting on these layers, trying to be generous. So I go trudging out into the snow. I have this little like camp chair that I was sitting in, and I just found a spot in the trees to sit. And I started sitting and doing kind of a basic awareness practice. And inevitably, my bad mood, as the snow started to fall and I felt warm enough and it was so soft and sweet, there was a sense of like, oh, this actually isn't so quite so bad as I thought. It's pretty peaceful, actually. And then as I settled and got even more soft and gentle, out of the corner of my eye, I saw something coming through and got closer and closer, closer and closer. Pretty soon, I realized this creature was going to walk right in front of me. And as it came out, you know, I was sort of trying to meditate and be good. And finally, it came into my field of vision. It was this beautiful bobcat. And it was so clearly a bobcat, you know, no tail, very pointed ears, spotted body, and this gaze. It stood right in front of me, like Mita Kenzie, bright green eyes I could see. Just in the snow falling, and there was this encounter, and it felt so, this is metta, so basic, so ordinary. We just looked at each other, and there wasn't any fear. They didn't have any fear. I didn't really have any fear. I mean, I sort of felt like, oh, I didn't really know what I felt, amazed. But it was a deliberate moment that it stayed looking. And then no rush. It was like so calm, just kept moving through the snow, like this graceful body. Yeah, moving through. And then I just sat there being like, blessings falling. It was amazing. It's a beautiful bobcat. So Ajahn Chah, he talks about this. He talks about this. He practiced all the time in the wilderness with wild creatures. He says, try to be mindful and let things take their natural course. Then your mind will become still in any surroundings like a clear forest pool. All kinds of wonderful, rare animals will come to drink at the pool, and you will clearly see the nature of all things. You will see many strange and wonderful things come and go, but you will be still. This is the happiness of the Buddha. And so even in this deep teaching by Ajahn Chah, I feel this sense of offering and receiving. That metta is just as much about learning to receive goodness, learning to see it in others, see it in ourselves, and really take that in, as much as it is about offering to those we care about, to those we don't know, to everybody. So Raymond Carver, in his poem Late Fragment, he says, did you get what you wanted from this life, even so? I did. And what did you want? To call myself beloved, to feel myself beloved on this earth. And I think this is what we're doing here. Whether it is a practice of receiving care, of receiving our own goodness, or whether it's a sense of appreciating our benefactors, our friends, offering our care, our goodwill to others, loving everyone back into wholeness. And the Buddha really said this explicitly. He said to Mahanama, Mahanama was one of his foremost disciples, he says, reflect frequently upon your virtue. And we don't usually do this. Usually we reflect on all of our mistakes, don't we? Our flaws. But how would it be, even in a daily kind of way, to wake up and think, oh, all the goodness that's here. Even your personal qualities. I know some of you, there's creativity in the room and expression and brilliancy. All of this is in us. Maybe good friendship, maybe a sense of diligence, of passion for the practice, scholarship, the ways we support our families and our world. Can we really take that in? Our love of poetry, our love of animals, our devotion. Can we take this in? Receive it as a metta practice? I feel this metta in Thich Nhat Hanh. This is a little kind of a reflecting, I think he's reflecting to himself. He says, I know what it is to get angry. And I know the pleasure of being praised. I'm often on the verge of tears or laughter. But beneath all these emotions, what else is there? How can I touch it? If there isn't anything, why would I be so certain that there is? And I think that is the goodness. That's what's underneath that we're touching, our tenderness, even our broken heart, this willingness to touch what's underneath, to honor it. And so just one more piece before we close, and this is about wholeheartedness. I know many of us who come to the refuge, we have a deep longing for freedom. And sometimes this kind of Dhamma Chanda, this desire for Dhamma, can feel very painful. It's like this longing we want so badly to be free. We're willing to do this boring, difficult practice day by day by day, some month after month. And we have to be willing. Sometimes, you know, we think it's something wrong with me because I'm suffering and I want it so bad. You know, I shouldn't want it so bad. This is clinging, or somehow I need to let go, but I still really want this practice. I want to get jhana, or I want to get nibbana. We have these goals and we want them. And a beloved teacher, I know some of you study with Rob Burbea. I got this transmission from Rob about how some of us, when we're in that kind of pain, it's a good kind of pain. You know, Rob says you have a strong horse. You don't have some kind of like puny little Devonshire pony. You have a stallion. And we just have to really learn how to ride a very strong horse. That's your Dhamma Chanda. It's not to be rid of. It's actually driving us to keep going on the path. We need it. And I love that image of a horse. It's wild. It's untamed. There's something in you that is going for freedom. And actually, it's just about getting out of the way. Because that wheel of Dhamma is turning. And no God or Brahman, recluse or human can stop it. So can you trust that deep, deep longing? And let it guide your way here. We set our aspirations and then we relinquish and let the Dhamma unfold in its own way. And it's all completely confusing and frustrating and roundabout and messy, organic, backwards kind of way. Because that's what it feels like. The Dhamma is this. And it leads us home again and again. So I always have tons of other stories and things to share, but we have a whole month. So I will share those with you later. And I'm just going to close with a poem by Jane Hirschfield, because I love Jane Hirschfield. She was a Zen. She's maybe a monk. At least she lived in a Zen center for a long time. You can feel her practice and her poetry. And this poem is called A Blessing. And so even as I read it, you might feel Jane's blessing for you through these words. And can you feel it as a sense of a metta practice of receiving care, of receiving this blessing? Today, when persimmons ripen, today, when fox kits come out of their den into snow, today, when the spotted egg releases its wren song, today, when the maple sets down its red leaves, today, when windows keep their promise to open, and when fire keeps its promise to warm, today, when someone you love has died, or someone you never met has died, when someone you love has been born, or someone you will not meet has been born, today, when rain leaps to the waiting of roots in their dryness, when starlight bends to the roofs of the hungry and tired, today, when someone sits long inside their last sorrow, and when someone steps into the heat of her first embrace, today, let this light bless you. With these friends, let it bless you. With snow scent and lavender, bless you. Let the vow of this day keep itself wildly and wholly spoken and silent. Surprise you inside your ears, sleeping and waking. Unfold itself inside your eyes. Let its fierceness and tenderness hold you. Let its vastness be undisguised in all your days. Let its fierceness and tenderness hold you. Let its vastness be undisguised in all your days. So we can just sit quietly for a moment or two before we chant together. And so I think the usual ritual at the Forest Refuge is that at the end of the talk we chant the sharing of blessings, which is on the back of your Refuges and Precepts chant.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.